The spirit of performance defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Right now in Fast, a sea change for streaming, the milestone just reached for the new generation of media watching and what it means for the legacy players. Plus, the rise in risks of single stock ETFs, why the leverage way to play some of the most volatile stocks is gaining popularity. And are they a better bet than meme stocks? And a Kohl's crash selling Bed Bath & Beyond and another shakeup at Starbucks. The stock's making moves, and we're watching the trades. I'm Melissa Lee. This is Fast Money, live from the Nasdaq Market Site in the heart of Times Square. On the desk tonight, Guy Adami, Tim Seymour, Karen Feinerman, and Steve Grasso. And we start off with streaming surge into TV superiority. The medium surpassing cable in July in terms of total minutes watched, according to Nielsen Research. Streaming seeing a nearly 23% year-on-year increase, while cable's viewership shrank nearly 9%. And the major players in the space are taking notice. The NCAA Big Ten Athletic Conference just signed a $7 billion deal with Fox, CBS, and NBC that includes eight college football games and dozens of college basketball games to be available exclusively on NBC's Peacock streaming service. So the script is officially flipped. Who are the winners? Guy.
Hi, Melms. It's just the two of us here.
It's just the two of us. Oh, thing. No, but we are.
No. There, obviously, I see Steve, I see Tim, I see Karen, I see everybody at the NASDAQ, I see all the crew.
Here on the desk.
That's correct.
The two of us.
It's nice. It's intimate, as they say. You know, it'd be great to have a guy like Tom Rogers tonight to talk about this, but in lieu of him, I'll start the conversation going. It's fascinating that Netflix, which now trades at 22 times next year's number, a number that I don't think anybody ever thought we would see, is not universally disliked, but a lot of skeptics. But when it was trading at 60 times, everybody loved it. Netflix continues to win. And I got to be honest, you know, the last 40 or so dollars has caught me by surprise. But again, Reed Hastings figuring out. But I'll submit this as well. Disney, you mentioned the sports aspect of this. Disney, ESPN got the lifeline years ago when sports gambling was legalized. I said it then, I'll say it now. Now Disney is trading from a position of strength in what they can do with ESPN if they choose to. And I would submit, at current levels, Disney is still too cheap, Milms.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see that streaming is winning, but there are also more streaming players. So one could argue that that piece of the pie is actually divided by many, 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 many more people, Tim. So how do you impute this on the valuation of a Disney, which you own, or Netflix, or some of the other streamers out there?
Which I also own, and wildly competitive. And at some point, you know, there's different ways the analyst community is actually evaluating these stocks. Some are just doing discounted cash flow models and doing it based upon subs. Some are doing it on a function, essentially a sales multiple, at least in terms of Disney, their core streaming business, then on an earnings multiple when you consider their core business. Just back to Netflix, though. I mean, yeah, in this secular trend that we've been talking about for a long time, the death of linear TV, Netflix has been the first and remains the first at 7.7% of all streaming hours viewed of this new record for streaming. So one of the things that I mentioned even on the day when Paramount announced is I just think that the streaming businesses and the companies have been ambushed on some level by the market in a sense that the competitive landscape is so much so that there will not be rationalization in price. So I think we are going to get back to a place. Remember when content was trading at such a massive premium. But look, at some point, and we can talk to Tom about the dynamics of Hulu and Disney and Comcast and, you know, who, you know, what's the proper bundle and where are we? But to me, I think there's opportunity in these stocks right here.
Yeah, I mean, we are seeing price increases, Karen, which implies that consumers, even in an inflationary environment, are willing to pay up for streaming services. And you would think that streaming services would have to keep prices very low and maybe even cut them in order to gain market share at this point, but they're not, which is a little bit surprising to me, at least. Mm-hmm.
Well, one thing that's sort of interesting that a lot of the streaming players are also legacy players, right? So they're kind of eating their own. And some, right, so you have Paramount Plus, which actually, remember, is CBS Go. So that's CBS. You have Disney, which is ABC. And you have Peacock, which is NBC. So they're kind of, you know, I don't know which effect is happening more quickly to the bottom line, whether it's the declining legacy business or the growing streaming where all the costs seem to be dumped on. I'm not really sure. So at the end of the day, half of the winners are the losers also, which I guess sort of leaves Netflix sort of the best of the bunch, I think.
Right. Or maybe even a Paramount Plus.
Although I'm long Paramount.
Yeah, yeah. Grasso, how do you come down on that? Because of that, I mean, if you're thinking that streaming is great and legacy TV is dying, as Karen points out, those two things coexist at many of these companies.
Yeah, so if you let's start off with where guys start off. So Netflix, when you look at it, it did shock a lot of people. It was trading way below the pandemic low. So you could make the case that it should have been trading below the slide from the pandemic, but it should not have been trading below the pandemic low. But after this recent run, we run into resistance. $250 is resistance in the name. That number comes from the slide that it took in that gap on earnings. You wouldn't want to be a buyer of Netflix right now. It's had a great run off that bottom, but you wouldn't be a buyer. But why? No one's mentioned this, and maybe for good reason, because the stock can't get out of its own way. If streaming is up, then shouldn't Roku eventually recover? The chart doesn't look great, but most charts that are bottoming or have bottomed don't look great either. Roku looks to me like it's very close to that bottoming area.
So you like Roku here?
Yeah, I mean, just based on how we opened the show, if you like streaming, it's hard for you. I own Disney, so I would be there because it has a bunch of levers to pull. But Roku, when you look at the chart and the way you open the show, should seem to be bottoming if that's the way the environment is going for streaming.
No, I understand what Steve is saying in terms of the chart. When you look over the last couple of weeks, I think it was Moffitt Nathanson just downgraded the stock, $62 price target. Pivotal downgraded the stock 2 days before. So the problem with Roku, I mean, chart notwithstanding, the problem is they don't make any money. And I think in terms of valuation, despite the fact that the stock has gotten obliterated, you're still talking about a stock that at these levels is just too expensive, regardless of the metric you look at.
If we had play, if we play the game,
oh, I love games.
I tell you about the company,
yeah.
and you tell me if it's defensive or not. I'll open the game to not just Guy here. A service that everybody wants, they're increasingly spending more time on, they're willing to pay higher prices, even in this inflationary environment. Is that a defensive stock, Guy? What do you say?
In this environment, that is a defensive stock.
That is a defensive.
Yes.
That is Netflix.
No, but yes, I agree with that.
Okay.
And Netflix, again, you can make a compelling argument on valuation. So defensive, and you can argue the valuation is compelling. But there are other stocks equally defensive that the valuation doesn't make sense. I think Roku might fall under that category. I don't know if I played the game right, but
That's about right. Karen, what do you think?
I'm going to go with Guy. I mean, I also, it's not in a vacuum. So there's a question of price. But even though I don't own Netflix here, it would lead me toward Netflix, although my book would say go with Paramount. As I do think that there is the possibility for consolidation, I don't think Netflix is a possible consolidator or consolidatee, whereas Paramount Plus could be.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, all these streaming services are still pursuing this ad-supported model at a time when the industry is having a tough go of it for ads, Tim. So how does that sort of play into the scenario where consumers are spending more time streaming, but they may end up paying less and these guys may have to shift towards an advertising, heavy advertising-dependent model?
That worries me about Netflix on some level. I think as they begin to assess other ways and you know, they start talking about price points for an ad-supported model. I'm hearing $8. I'm hearing $9. And I do think that the issue around the streaming companies is the competitive landscape that makes us question pricing power. 2 years ago, we thought Netflix had all the pricing power in the world, and they passed that through to their customers. I think what we're underappreciating, you talk about the ad-supported model, we are underappreciating with Netflix their ability to draw back in the shared accounts, and then possibly some new. If you listen to Cowen's numbers, they say there's probably 14 million shared accounts that they will begin to monetize. Again, not $18.99 a month, but maybe $3 or $4 an additional month. And then that will also, though, lead to an additional almost 2 million new subs. That's the part of the Netflix story that I'm just surprised they're not being rewarded for rather than being punished for the discussion that, hey, we're concerned about sub growth. Maybe we need to go to an ad-supported model. By the way, that doesn't put them in the penalty box, I don't think. That's addressing what's going on. The consumer is now willing to, the streaming consumer is starting to consume product much in the way we did on linear TV. And that's the big surprise. We will watch ads, and it depends on the format.
Well, listen, it's interesting to me, and I agree with Tim. It's interesting to me when I play the game remotely correctly, I get ridiculed. When Karen plays, I mean, she creates her own rule. I mean, Karen did it. It's beautiful. Everything's beautiful. I mean, it makes me crazy. It's clear favoritism on the set of CNBC's Fast Money. And I'm putting my foot down.
It is what it is. Well, let's move on. Joining us now for more on this is CNBC founder and Target Media Executive Chairman Tom Rogers. Tom, great to have you with us. I think that the new data that came out just sort of reaffirms what we all knew about what was going on in the TV landscape. So I want to start off with you with how you think about the media giants that have both parts of the business, the linear part of the business as well as the streaming part of the business, and how each should sort of weigh in thinking about the valuation.
Well, it's a great question, Melissa. Thanks for having me, and thank you for not putting me in the middle of the favoritism battle here. I think that what Paramount Plus and Peacock did in terms of being able to feed both the broadcast side of the equation and the streaming side of the equation is a very smart play. It's clear that linear television is increasingly becoming all about sports and news. It's why Fox is most buy-rated of the traditional media companies, because it is essentially a company now that is all about just sports and news. And on the streaming side, as we were talking about, that advertising is now going to be a critical part of all the streamers' business models. There's nothing that drives eyeballs like sports. And so they have a need to fuel that side as well. I think the fact of the matter is that you have to look at who lost here. And I heard the conversation on Disney and ESPN. To me, the big loser here is ESPN.
It's interesting. I'll just say it now to get out of the way. Tom is a stud, so that's out of the way. But it's one of those, we know these truths to be self-evident, number one. Number two, it was inevitable, I guess, but in October of last year, Netflix finally fell on hard times. Stock from 700 to 162. You know all about it. But can there be a rebirth here in Netflix? Because to the conversation we had, now it's done, you have valuation that's compelling, and the world seems to once again be lining up for everything that Reed Hastings is doing.
I think it's inevitable that Netflix recovers more and is ultimately viewed as the winner. Because what isn't being factored in sufficiently, certainly in the case of Disney, but most of the traditional media companies that are pushing into streaming, is just how difficult the decline of the traditional business is going to be, how cord cutting is accelerating, how ratings are declining. And while sports rights is certainly a good thing to help stabilize ratings, the fact of the matter is when you're paying that much more for rights and you have diminished audience, that just squeezes margins against very tough conditions already. Netflix doesn't have to deal with any of that. And while people have focused on Netflix subscriber issues, they really don't have a subscriber issue. They reach 100 million households in the United States, more households than any cable or broadcast network has ever reached. Their issue, as you were discussing before, as Tim mentioned, is the monetization issue. How do you monetize 30 million homes that they're not getting paid for in that 100 million household reach that they have? And I think as they figure that out, you have an awful lot of opportunity, not to mention the fact that the engagement they have at 30% of all connected TV audience viewing compared to Disney Plus at 5% just gives them maybe not the pricing power people originally thought, but pricing power nonetheless when you have that much of the engagement share of the total streaming audience, which is now bigger than cable.
Tom, or should I call you Stud, as we look at the horse trading among some of the assets out there, let's talk about Hulu, because this is fascinating when you think about the players involved. And actually, who necessarily would want Hulu's business? And there's some question as to why Disney would even want that business. But what do you think is going to happen there? Could Comcast turn around and be a buyer? Or is this asset going to Disney at some point for at least $24 billion or more?
Well, I can make an argument for why each of them could use it strategically. I think that it was the case that there were different buying conditions when Netflix was at 700. Disney, I'm sure, using Netflix as a yardstick, would be much more interested in buying it when there's a comparison of Netflix at 240. And similarly, I'm sure Comcast doesn't like the idea of selling it when the leading comp is where it is. I think the thing that really has to be focused on with Hulu is it is the leading advertiser streamer. It is the one that has been out there before everybody else said that they were going to enter the advertising realm when it comes to streaming. They were the leading advertising service. And one of the things that just got no focus on Disney earnings is that for the last three quarters in a row, the advertising revenue per Hulu sub has declined. Now, that is a really bad, so this was before recessionary issues began to push down advertising revenue. So what is going on there that their ad revenue per sub was declining as Hulu was the clear leader, and now everybody else is going to have a ad tier as part of their offering with some great premium programming to compete with the Hulu inventory? That has to be taken into account as you think about it, not to mention that all the either all the NBC programming is going away if Disney buys it, or all the Disney programs going away if NBC buys it. And it will be a very different service in that regard.
Yep. Tom, it's always great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Tom, I'm not Rogers. Well, they think you are, so that's the way it is. We've got some breaking news here that we want to get to. A news alert on Home Depot, the company announcing a dividend and authorizing a share buyback. Seema Modi's got the details. Seema.
Hey, Melissa. Home Depot authorizing a new $15 billion buyback. It comes just 2 days after the company reported better than expected earnings thanks to an increase in home improvement spending. And it also follows the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act that does impose a 1% tax on buybacks. So certainly interesting timing. You're seeing shares of Home Depot up about 0.5% here in extended trade. Mel?
All right, Seema. Thanks, Seema Modi. Karen, this sounds like a big number.
It's a big number, but it's a giant company. But, mm-hmm. you know, for years, this has been part of Home Depot's playbook, and they've done a great job. And obviously, we know how under pressure the housing sector is. But, you know, I thought their earnings this week were fine. And I'm long Home Depot and long Lowe's.
Coming up, we're all over the after hours action and AIM at shares on the move after reporting results. We'll bring you the numbers next. Plus, meme trades, cryptocurrencies, and now single stock ETFs, the rise and the risks of these high vol investment funds. Don't go anywhere. Fast Money's back in two.
Hi, I'm Ben Rizzuto, wealth strategist at Janus Henderson Investors. Is a brighter future possible? At Janus Henderson, we think it is. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. We know that this means our thinking and our investments are helping to shape millions of futures. At Janus Henderson, we are committed to helping you invest in a brighter future for the next 90 years and beyond. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
What does it mean to be rich? Maybe it's less about reaching a magic number and more about discovering the magic in life. At Edward Jones, our dedicated financial advisors are the people you can count on for financial strategies that help support a life you love. Because the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Learn more about our comprehensive approach to planning at edwardjones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Welcome back to Fast Money. We have an earnings alert on Applied Materials. Shares of the chip equipment maker moving higher after posting better than expected earnings and revenue for its latest quarter. Let's get back to Seema Modi, who's got the details. Hey, Seema.
Melissa, on the earnings call, Applied Material executives revealed some new Q4 numbers. They expect semi-systems revenue to be up 14% year over year in the fourth quarter and to incrementally increase gross margins through pricing adjustments and improved logistic costs. It's also slowing its headcount growth while increasing research and development spending up 10% year to date. But like many semiconductor players, the zero lockdown in China did set them back. Most of its display revenue comes from China, that market there. It's one of the reasons for 2023, Applied Materials says demand is still above our ability to supply. They're working through the supply chain issues, trying to identify them, tackle those issues, and they do see output increasing over the next several quarters. Stock is up about 2% in after hours, still down about 33% from its 52-week high. Melissa?
Seema, thanks. Seema Modi. Steve Grasso, what do you make of the quarter?
So, you know how I don't feel incredibly bullish about this sector of stocks, but this one was in a declining trend line from January. It broke out of that at the end of July. It's trading above its 50-day and its 100-day. The only thing it has to shoot for is its 200-day moving average. I would use the 100-day, which is about 107, as a floor. Buy the stock. Look for a run to the 200-day as resistance, which is at 125. Let it settle in a little bit tomorrow, see how the character of the trading affects it. But I do believe they have an outsized exposure to solar panels. And with the recent bill that passed through Congress, they could reap the rewards of that. So I would look for a run at the 200-day.
AMAT's its own animal, no question. And Steve was right to be cautious about semis, the whole space many months ago. I'll say this quickly. The quarter was fine. Guidance was fine. Operating margins hung in there. I think the stock is now trades 13 times next year's numbers, which I don't want to get crazy about, because if this becomes a commoditized thing, that's a problem. I would wait until see what NVIDIA has to say on the 24th, just to reset this entire space, because although they guided a couple weeks ago, they didn't give you the quarter. The quarter's still coming up, and there are a lot of people out there whispering that maybe they'll guide lower again. Just something to keep in mind before you go foraying into the semi space, Melissa Lee. See what I did there?
Very dramatic.
Thank you.
Much more Fast Money to come. Here's what's coming up next.
Stocks or ETFs? Why not both? The investing craze that has some big volatility. The details next. Plus, retail wreck. Kohl's slashing guidance and blaming inflation for a sales slump. So should you keep shopping, or is it time to check out? You're watching Fast Money, live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this.
For more than a decade, Comcast has been committed to bridging the digital divide and connecting millions to affordable high-speed internet. But the barriers to get connected go well beyond affordability. Through Project Up, Comcast is committing $1 billion to reach millions with digital skills training, resources, and opportunities needed to succeed in a digital world. Project Up, building a future of unlimited possibilities. Learn more at comcast.com/projectup.
Welcome back to Fast Money, a new way to trade volatile stocks, including Tesla and NVIDIA. Single stock ETFs hitting the marketplace this summer, designed to make shorting simpler for active investors. But do the risks outweigh the benefits? Let's get some answers from Tom Lydon, the vice chairman of market analytics firm Vettify. Tom, great to see you.
Hi, Melissa.
Why do we need these ETFs when there are the stocks themselves that you can trade or options?
Yeah, short answer is it's more optionality for individual investors, sophisticated traders who don't necessarily want to use all their cash that they have on the sidelines. They can get some leverage. They can also go inverse. And, you know, most investors have to fill out margins and options agreements in order to do that. It's a great way for them to hedge, but you have to watch it every day. It's also a great way to get hedging instruments for financial advisors. As the market's been really volatile, and the stocks that these represent are some great opportunities to pick them up off the bottom, or if you're not happy about them, you can buy the short side without having to do any margin.
But when you're talking about hedging, you're not talking about using the leverage products, because the leverage products, you would not, I mean, ostensibly, you really shouldn't hold them for more than a day. Am I right?
No, you should. You're right. So you guys were just talking about chips and earnings and things like that. So if these products, like they represent NVIDIA, if you feel like earnings are going to go south, you can go in for a given day. And on the Access NVIDIA Bear ETF, 1.25 to the negative, you can get that leverage to the downside and short by using ultimately a long vehicle.
Tom, are these trading vehicles, to Mel's question, or are they vehicles for professionals that are, you know, hedge funds that are trying to get that leverage? Because it sounds like for the average everyday investor, these could be dangerous, for lack of a better word.
They could. So, Guy, you're right. It's not for the average investor, although ETFs, for the most part, have been. They continue to evolve to try to grab more of the marketplace. But listen, you're absolutely right. They are aggressive in nature. They have to be traded almost on a daily basis. But for some investors that are sophisticated, or advisors or institutions, they come into play because it wraps everything up into one ticker.
Hey, Tom, it's Steve. So just a couple of things, just to piggyback. The other issue is they're based on a derivative which decays. So you have the fee of the ETF. It resets every day, and you have the decay of the derivative that it's actually based on. So just to piggyback what was already said, though, it's got to be a day event that you're trading, but it doesn't come with a disclaimer that if you hold it longer than a day, you're actually decaying your money.
Well, you're right. So there's almost reverse compounding that's built into this, Steve. However, let's just say there are companies like ProShares and Direction that have had inverse and leverage ETFs out there for 10 years. Look, we all have to be responsible in what we're buying and selling. And we know, yes, the SEC is looking at this. FINRA has this complex product rule out there right now under review. They would like to be able to put some guardrails on for average investors buying in their brokerage account, or make them go through some type of training, or make them go through more disclosure or things like that. But ultimately, as investments advance, you got to give credit to the average investor to do their due diligence. And if they're not comfortable, if they haven't looked under the hood, they should run in the opposite direction.
Tom, thanks. Tom Lydon of Vettify. So, Karen, again, these are single stock ETFs, some of them leveraged to varying degrees on volatile stocks. As a professional hedge fund manager, right, would you use these as vehicles, or would you opt for other ways, like the options market, for instance?
What could go wrong? Really, Missy, right? What could go wrong with this? We've seen a couple times, you know, the volatility index or whatever it was. We saw the USO, which is, I know, maybe a little different animal because it's got different parts of the oil complex, but or oil contracts going out. It just seems like, you know, if you're a sophisticated investor who can understand the downsides of this, I would think it would be easier to create it yourself. Just my guess.
Right, Tim?
First of all, I mean, Tom Lydon's been a godfather in the ETF space a long time. I think the idea is that the ETF space continues to evolve and continues to dominate. And on some level, the retail investor is given more tools that institutions have. Look, institutions can create baskets and options very quickly. They have the ability to single short stocks. A lot of retail investors can't even short stocks based upon the platform they're on. Everything we've said so far, though, is absolutely true. I say buyer beware. Do your work, even with main ETFs. Understand what's under the hood. These leverage ETFs, we've talked about them for a long time. I think they are dangerous. But if you know and if you are tactical and if you are in and out and you are right, obviously, that's what it is. It's leverage.
Yeah, Grasso, you've used these, actually.
I've actually used these. So for as long as these have existed, I've used them, clients have used them. And the biggest issue is, no matter how sophisticated the institution or the trader, traders don't realize that they're one-day vehicles. So it decays. That is the biggest problem that I have with them. If you can tell people, you're only using these for 6.5 hours during the trading day, I have no problem with it. But most people are not going to follow those instructions if they are not notified. And there's nothing on these ETFs that tell you that it's a one-day thing.
All right. Coming up, the latest on Ryan Cohen's Bed Bath & Beyond sale. Shares are dropping again after hours. The details that Karen's watching ahead. But first, Kohl's cuts. The retailer slashing guidance as rising prices hit shoppers. So now even Kohl's cash is feeling the inflation sting. We're breaking that down next when Fast Money returns.
Get your trades to go with the Fast Money podcast. Catch us anytime, anywhere. Follow today on your favorite podcasting app. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to Fast Money. We've got a buzzkill on Kohl's. Shares sinking almost 8% after the retailer slashed full-year outlook during its latest earnings report. The company citing a hard-hit middle-income consumer. Here's what CEO Michelle Gass said about the updated guidance earlier on the exchange.
We are expecting the back half of the year to be more promotional as the customer's looking for that value. We're also facing inflationary pressures in our cost of goods and things like freight. How long this is going to go on, not sure, but we are doing lots of things around our business to make sure that we can navigate this period of time.
Kohl's now expects full-year revenues to decline versus last year, and earnings estimates have been trimmed by more than half. Karen, this really was not a surprise to you.
You know, I had a grandmother that used to say, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. But I have a daughter who would say, Mom, say what you really think. So, you know, it wasn't about the giant miss, which we knew when they announced those earnings. No way were they going to meet those. It wasn't about the whopping inventory bloat. It wasn't about the category misses. To me, it's about a very, very pressured industry, department stores, and a management team who I don't trust, right? I think they did a horrific job selling the company and at the same time instead trying to pull their own, you know, this is our new plan and it's fabulous, and misleading the shareholders. I can't get over that. So if you want to make that bet for maybe there's a really cheap department store out there that can get it together and can survive, you got to go to Macy's or somewhere else. I don't trust them.
You
maybe
still own this.
Maybe I should, but I can't.
You still own this
no.
stock, though. Oh, you don't. You're completely out.
No, I'm completely out.
Okay. Tim, what do you think?
Well, first of all, Karen's been noticeably irritated by this story, as she should be. And this puts more pressure on management, right? So the shares are undervalued. It doesn't mean you chase them. But I think there's a lot of bad news and there's a lot of bad management in this. And it only sets them up that much more for some of the same pressure that they've been under. They can't persist in this environment. So don't really love department stores. Really don't like their segment. I think, you know, we have Macy's and Nordstrom's reporting next week. And I think they've got slightly different segments. And I think that's part of the story where they've been more resilient. Also, the inventory issues that coals are going through are very similar, of course, what we're seeing in many other places. The difference is this is a company that doesn't necessarily have the same ability to have a footfall. They're just not in that position. They don't have the same liquidity. And this is something I think investors are focusing on.
Bill Simon yesterday said that department stores have to find a reason to exist. So not only do they have their own internal, maybe management created, management enhanced issues to deal with, but they have an industry problem to deal with as well. They sell things that people do not need. You don't have to go there at all. And that's a problem, Guy.
Unless you're returning Amazon stuff, right?
Right, exactly.
Which, you know, I'm one of those people. I actually go to, like, the UPS. We chat.
I also UPS drop off my Amazon
returns. Isn't that nice? Anyway. Let me put a couple numbers around, just so we understand each other. Their prior guidance for EPS was basically $6.50. They guided to basically $3. Now, by the way, the street didn't believe them either because the consensus was $4 and they missed that. Then they took operating margins from 7.5%-ish down to 4%. I don't know what happened over that period of time, but clearly none of it was good. So to Karen's earlier point, I dig her grandmother. I'm sure I'd never met her, but I'm sure I would have. But I'm with her daughter on this one. Tell the truth. And the truth in this case hurts.
Coming up. Shares of Bed Bath & Beyond sinking in the after hours as a major shareholder cashes out. What the chairwoman is watching in this filing, that is next. Plus another shakeup at Starbucks as its COO departs. So with another exec on the way out, how should you play the coffee chain? We've got the details when Fast Money returns. Welcome back to Fast Money. It is official. Ryan Cohen's RC Ventures has sold its entire stake in Bed Bath & Beyond. The AMC GME chairman offloading the stock on Tuesday and Wednesday for prices between $18 and $30 a share. He also sold his call options expiring in January, shares of Bed Bath, adding to their losses in the after hours. So, Karen, you've been watching this very closely. What did you see in this filing?
So this filing showed all the prices that he sold. It looks to me like he made $59 million off of about $119 million investment, which is great. But really, I think it's that he made that money off of what was a much lower base after he got into it, right? Shares really, really sold off hard after he got into it in January. And I think that I think shareholders are going to be upset that, oh, he bailed on us. But this is a very, very different story now than March when he got into it. As recently as a couple of months ago, Bed Bath & Beyond was in a position to feel like they could do share buybacks. Now, I think they're getting restructuring help because their debt's trading like they're going to go bankrupt. So I don't blame him for getting out. It's a very, very different equation now. So I know people are pissed at him. I got no skin in this game at all. I don't know him. I'm just saying a little bit of caveat emptor. If you followed him in here on the idea of, oh, my God, he bought, calls struck at 75. This must be great. Even though the debt was telling you it's going bankrupt. One other thing I think is interesting. GameStop, apparently, on the back of this news is down $4 because people hate Ryan, I guess. I got no feelings. Never met the guy.
Or they question, whether his staying power in any of these names. And I agree with you. I see that how it is a very different story at this point in time for Bed Bath & Beyond. The stock is down 40% right now, Guy. An extraordinary move.
No, and it's unfortunate. Again, we talked about this last night. And again, I don't think he did anything. I don't think any of us are saying he did anything illegal. My problem is it doesn't pass the sniff test. And the fact that, listen, Karen pointed this out last night. The options, if you went and looked at the filing, they were there. But somehow, magically, it just came to the public domain over the last couple days when magically the stock traded up to nearly $30. And then magically, once again, he decided it was a good point to exit. I don't think, my opinion, which I'm entitled to, he ever thought in his wildest dreams this stock was going to $75. What I do think, though, is he understood intuitively what's going on in the market now. Mm-hmm. And if people got their arms around that, it would be somewhat self-fulfilling that the stock would go up. That's the problem that I have.
I have to say that just as sort of a, mainstream media plays a role in this whole thing, too. So, I mean, discussion of the options, positions that he had that were disclosed in a 13D filing from months ago, we talked about that as well. So it's all part, we talked about it because the stock was moving. And after the stock moved, then we discussed that. So it's all this sort of crazy viral thing that, feeds on itself, Tim.
Well, that's the world of social media, meme stocks, Reddit chat rooms and whatnot. But I it is interesting, you know, why did we have to see notice of options purchases from months ago yesterday or the day before? And the discussion that I'm hearing about, well, they had to restate the percentages based upon there was a different share count outstanding. And so that, you know, it equated to slightly different option positions. Like, I'm not sure that news was necessary to restate. And so that's where I think people are a little frustrated here, that news came to market magically when, in fact, it wasn't necessary to have it come to market.
All right, let's stick with retail trader favorites. AMC, one of the most active names in the options market today, but one trader is betting that the stock is headed for huge losses. Mike Coe has the action. Mike.
Yeah, so certainly Bed Bath & Beyond was the busiest single stock option this week, and it was the busiest one today. But the other meme stock that continues to occupy a high slot when it comes to the single stock options activity is AMC. It ranked fifth today. We did see double the average daily put volume. And of course, a lot of retail market participants are getting involved, but it's not just retail, because among the trades we saw was a purchase of over 2,000 of the September 12 puts. Those traded for 44 cents. So that could be retail, but it's high net retail for sure. Buyer of those puts betting that the weakness that some of these stocks are starting to see could infect AMC as well, and it could decline below 12 by September expiration.
All right. Thank you, Mike, for that. For more options action, tune into the full show. That's tomorrow, 5:30 p.m. Eastern time. Coming up, another shakeup at Starbucks. How the latest departure will impact the coffee chain. We're breaking it down next. Fast Money's back in two. Welcome back. Here's a sneak peek at the Cramer Cam. Jim is talking to the CEO of Generac. Catch the full exclusive interview at the top of the money, at top of the hour, excuse me, on Mad Money. And another leadership shakeup at Starbucks. COO John Culver, the latest executive to leave the coffee giant. This just a year after he took on the role, and just months before Howard Schultz is set to depart as CEO. Our Kate Rogers has got the details on this. Kate.
Melissa, that's right. COO at Starbucks, John Culver, will be departing the company at the end of the year, transitioning to executive advisor as of October 3rd. The company is reorganizing the leadership team, eliminating the COO role at the end of the fiscal year. Culver, as you said, has been with the company for 20 years, took over for Roz Brewer after she left for the CEO role at Walgreens. In his in a letter from Howard Schultz to partners about the executive structure change, Schultz said, quote, "Our reinvention requires us to rethink our leadership structure to create every opportunity for our new CEO, and most importantly, to accelerate delivery of modernized and elevated experiences for our Green Apron partners and our customers." Now, that reinvention has been a very big focus for Schultz, who will also be leaving the company at the end of the calendar year. The new CEO has yet to be named, but the company is speaking to external candidates for that role. And this is the fourth exec departure in the last 2 years or so. We had Brewer leaving in early 2021, then former CEO Kevin Johnson in March of this year, Rossann Williams, the EVP of North America's in June, and now John Culver. Back over to you.
Major changes. Kate, thanks. Kate Rogers. Steve Grasso, what do you make of Starbucks?
Yeah, forgetting all of that, all the fundamentals on, I shouldn't say the fundamentals, but forgetting about the corporate shakeup, the stock has broken out of a declining trend line pretty recently. There is a scarcity value in coffee. You don't really get that many publicly traded coffee companies anymore. I would wait till it trades above the 200-day moving average, which is right around $90. But technically, the 50 has popped above the 100. That's bullish. I would give it a little bit of air to breathe, and I'd be a buyer above 90.
Tim, what do you think?
Well, look, the last quarter, we just got numbers. The U.S. comps were excellent. It was all on price increases. The China business was destroyed. We kind of knew that was going to happen. Some of that's all been reset. The dynamic here is a combination of to what extent, where are margins going for the company. That includes labor costs. Again, they've got big union issues. They just ordered that they had to rehire a bunch of folks in Memphis and some union activists and whatnot. And they've created their own kind of internal turmoil here. And I realize that some of this is going on in other places, but Starbucks, I think, has really brought some of this upon themselves. If you look at the leadership dynamic, I think the company, since Kevin Johnson sat in that role, has been a little bit rudderless. And if you look at, you know, they start using things about reinvention and whatnot, it makes you feel as if this is a company that's lost. I don't think they're that lost. But I do think that the dynamic around the shares is we still need to see that CEO in place. And right now, yeah, Howard Schultz needs to name a new CEO. This is preparation for that.
Yeah, you need to see what the vision is, and we don't have a handle on that. So you have the internal problems, then you have the external problems. I mean, Walmart was talking about, household incomes over $100,000 going to Walmart now, people trading down from deli meats to cans of beans, Guy. And you got to wonder, I mean, is all of this happening so you can still buy your $5 cup of regular coffee down the street?
I could say without equivocation,
or
Melissa,
are you just cutting that too?
Beans are not part of my.
Oh, I know that.
Just so you should have been a better. You should have given me a better
example that he used.
Yeah, but you could have changed it for me. Number one, number two, I don't think that's necessarily a good thing, but that's for farther down the road in terms of how we're going to look at the consumer things. But I'll say this about Starbucks. I'm glad Tim put it up, and check out Kate Rogers' Twitter account because she's on top of it. This labor issue is not going away, and I fear it's going to get worse before it gets better. And although Starbucks at 25 times next year's numbers is cheap historically to itself, I don't think that's a metric you want to look at right now.
Up next, final trades. Time for the final trade, Steve.
Chewy, it's up 90% in about 3 months. I expect a lot more upside. Try to keep it on a short leash in case it turns back around.
Karen?
Short leash. Got it, Steve. Yeah. So Ulta, name that I own, it's had a very nice run up $40 in the last, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks. Earnings a week from now. But I'm going to sell some upside 425 calls at about 7.5 because it's come so far so fast.
Tim Seymour.
Happy birthday to my beautiful daughter, Skye. And that Netflix discussion, streaming discussion with Tom Rogers was fascinating, as it always is. Netflix is underappreciated by the market here.
Guy.
Big daughter night effect. Karen brought up her daughter, Tim, Skye. Happy birthday, Skye. Slumberjay, Melms. Look at that energy. It's making the move higher again.
All right. Thanks for watching Fast. See you back here tomorrow at 5. Meantime, Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.